supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Support for Voices in the Family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Well, digital psychotherapy, online psychotherapy, chat rooms. I'll tell you, that passing through the ears of a psychotherapist like me who's been in practice for 40 years, I mean, I got my teeth bared. I'm ready to go into the studio today and go after these people about all they're missing. And then I realized 22 years ago, I started a radio show called Family Matters, which turned into Voices in the Family. And that radio show was not just simple Q&A with an online shrink. It was me actually engaging people who called in and hearing about their lives. And my conscious agenda for that was to introduce psychotherapy to the larger audience and what it was really like. And I guess my newspaper column can be considered that, and now I blog, and now I have a chat. So, you know, I never shied away from hypocrisy. I embrace the adventure. So we're going to talk about this business. What is it? What does it really do? And what does it mean? So on today's show, we're going to talk about how digital psychotherapy works, what the tools we are using, email, social networking sites, video conferencing, what are the pros and cons? How is it paid for? What about credentials? And most importantly is, can it be effective? So joining me now to answer all of these questions and more are Drs. James Herbert and John Grohol. Herbert's a director of the Anxiety Treatment and Research Program here at Drexel University. John Grohol's a psychologist. He's founder of PsychCentral.com, which is, I'm guessing, one of the largest psychology web pages and one of the most respected and one of my favorites. Jim Herbert, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Dan. Thanks very much.
And John, welcome to you to the show.
Great to be here.
And if you want to join our conversation, our number is 888-477-9499. Later in the show, we're going to be joined by Dr. Fred Thomas. He's director of community-based mental health services at the University of Texas Medical Branch in Galveston, and he started a really interesting program out there. So, John, let's start with you. Let's understand the many dimensions of what online therapy really means. It could range from email to video conferencing. How many dimensions are we talking about?
Sure. I mean, online therapy has come a long way in just the short time that it's been available. It includes modalities such as email, chat rooms, video conferencing, and you could even argue that that web-based programs that use cognitive behavioral techniques are available that actually help guide a person through many of those techniques, but don't actually have a person helping them. It's all software-based programs that they could also be considered a form of online interventions or online therapy.
You wrote an article, John, where you said that online psychotherapy is a new type of therapy, and it's not simply psychotherapy translated online. So what is it? What are the unique characteristics that you've said go with online therapy?
Sure. It is a new type of psychotherapy, just like play therapy for a child isn't quite the same as adult psychotherapy is, but uses psychotherapeutic techniques to affect change in a person's, you know, behavior or emotions. So online therapy really focuses on providing and helping a person find solutions to usually pretty specific problems. So you could argue that it's a pretty solution-focused type of psychotherapy that emphasizes the communication that is available to most people, such as text-based communication. So like a lot of online communications, when we email someone or when we chat with them in a chat room, it people tend to do so in a more disinhibited fashion. So it allows people to really talk about the issues without sort of beating around the bush.
You've also said that online therapy uses the richness of language to help bring about change in a client's life, and the language is a core component of communication, and of course it is. But here's where I want to argue. I might argue that language is simply a vehicle to communicate something else, something deeper that can't be verbalized, things like compassion, genuine care, even faith in one's internal resources.
Well, I wouldn't disagree with you too much. I think all of those things are not only important but vital to a traditional psychotherapeutic relationship. But I think what we're finding and what the research is showing is that the traditional psychotherapy relationship doesn't exist in this in an online therapy context. That sure, there's a relationship there with the professional, but it plays a more of a secondary role compared to the role it plays in traditional face-to-face psychotherapy.
Hmm. To our audience, does online therapy make sense to you? Is there a place for it? Do you see it as able to substitute for traditional therapy? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. James Herbert, I want to turn to you. Now, for your work, you're using something called Second Life for your research project. We did a radio show on Second Life last year, but since you're closer to it than I am, give us a cliff notes on what Second Life is.
Well, sure, Dan. Second Life is an online virtual community. So it's a parallel community, just like a world, really, with stores and schools and lectures and houses and a lot of people. And each person is represented by an avatar. So if you and I were on Second Life right now, you would be sitting there, your avatar would be sitting there, and I would be standing here or sitting here with my avatar. And each of us controls our avatar, our little person, kind of like a Wii Me, if you're using the Wii system. We control our avatars, and we can move them around. We can make them talk. We can either use a keyboard to type messages back and forth to each other, or we can use a headset, just like we're wearing now, and we can talk to one another, just as though we're talking right now. The only difference is, instead of looking at you, I'm looking at a little representation of you, and vice versa. But I can make that representation stand up, move around, do whatever. So what we're doing is we have a psychotherapy room, a consultation room. It's nicely decorated, looks like a nice office, and we meet there. And so your avatar, at a prescribed time, you and I would meet there. We would walk in. We have it set up that it's completely confidential. No one knows that you're there, that I'm there.
Wait. Let me stop you there.
Okay.
How do you do that?
Well, this is called the magic of computer programming. And you can have settings with the Second Life environment allows you to set it up so that I, as the therapist, essentially own that room, and I can prescribe who can come in there. So what I would do, I would say at noon, Dan Gottlieb has access to this room, but no one else does besides me. So you can enter the room, but no one else can enter even within a certain radius of that room. So it's completely confidential, and our communications are confidential. So in there, we can do psychotherapy. Now, the problem is I can't see you. I can't see the nonverbals on your face, the hand gestures you might make. You can technically make the little avatar make gestures, but the technology's still somewhat crude, and so the gestures are kind of exaggerated. But I certainly am not seeing your face. But what I can do is still interact with you, talk with you, and have that representation of you. And that can be useful for certain kinds of therapy. So one of the things we're working with is people with extreme social anxiety.
So you answered my question that I was about to ask,
okay.
Is why would I come into this little room where you can't see me? Why wouldn't I go into your office?
Well, good question. I would say there's two reasons for that. The first and most important is if you live in a place where there is not a well-trained, qualified person who's up to speed. I mean, there's a lot of places in our country where people don't get any services, and if they do, they're not getting services from an expert. So if you're in a small town somewhere and there's not an expert around, then the idea is we can bring this technology, we can bring this expertise to the individual in a remote site. That's really the driving force. Now, there's a secondary thing with social anxiety that might make it especially relevant, and that is kind of like some other conditions like agoraphobia, there are some people that aren't yet ready to come see someone, that by the very nature of the condition is such that they're not ready to come consult with a person in person. So they feel more comfortable doing it in the sheltered privacy behind their computer.
Well, then in a case like that, I would imagine then the goal would be to get me out and into your office.
Well, perhaps. The real goal is getting you out into your life, getting you doing the things that you're not doing, whether that's dating, whether it's at a job, speaking up in public, whatever it may be. Our question that we're trying to address is, we know if someone will come to the office that there's a pretty good chance we can help them. The question is, can we help them just as well remotely? And quite honestly, I'm not sure. I'm optimistic based on our preliminary work, but the jury's still out.
I want to come back and address the bigger picture with both of you, James and John. I want to talk about what people can get online that they can't get with regular therapy. One thing I find, and John, you know, I diminished the value of the written word in an earlier question, but I find the written word often in my therapy helpful. It takes the intensity out of the interaction. It takes the affect. I often, when I'm working with married couples, I have them email communication to each other to diminish the affect. Your thoughts, John?
Sure. I think that's a very valid point, and that people who are in a very emotional state can find the written word to be a way of sort of accessing their more cognitive side of their personality or whatnot, and remove some of that emotional messages that go along with relationship communications. But one of the things that we've been learning about being online is that, of course, you can communicate a great deal of emotionality through the written word. I mean, Shakespeare showed that to us many hundreds of years ago. So I think what we're actually kind of learning is this of embracing the written word again and learning how to use it to express ourselves more fully and meaningfully.
I want to talk a little bit more with both of you about telephone psychotherapy and if there's any research on this. I've treated a couple of people on the telephone. I'm treating someone now on the telephone out in Seattle, and frankly, I find it pretty difficult. It's different than telephone interactions here with listeners, because these feel like a consultation, or even when I have a phone session with a regular patient who can't come in for a week, but to do ongoing therapy on the telephone, I find more difficult. It feels to me like something significant is missing, and it's harder for me to be involved. It feels like second best to me. And either of you have any thoughts, James?
Sure. Well, I would say the same thing. I mean, I would say I agree with you that it feels different. It feels awkward. It feels strange. And I've done the same thing. I've done telephone therapy. I would say using the Second Life environment, to me, feels strange. But there's two points I would make. First is, I wonder how much of that is generational. Even though I like to think of myself as a spring chicken, I'm really not anymore.
No.
And neither are you, right? So part of it is the, you know, my daughter, for example, who's just graduating from high school, or my son who's in middle school, they're digital natives. They grow up with this technology. I have a feeling that in a few years, things like this are going to seem much more familiar to them than they do to us. The second point I would make, though, is even if it feels strange, the real question is, does it work? And it's possible that it works just as well, or maybe not. We don't know yet, but that's why we need research. But even if it feels weird, doesn't necessarily mean we can't assume that it therefore isn't going to work as well. And ultimately, we're after the bottom line of what's going to help our patients.
That's interesting. John, I'd love to hear you weigh in on that.
I really would just have to agree with what James has said. I think that we're seeing a real shift in how people are communicating with one another. And, of course, younger generations, which grow up on this technology, take it for granted, just like we did. We took the telephone for granted as we were growing up, and it could have been a mystery to our parents or grandparents.
I'm curious of our listeners, if you'd be interested in having therapy from your home, knowing that it was more convenient, perhaps less expensive, or telephone psychotherapy, give us a call. Number's 888-477-9499. That's what we're talking about on today's show. We're talking about online, digital, telephone psychotherapy, I guess alternative psychotherapies, for lack of a better word. John Crowell is my guest. He's a psychologist and founder of PsychCentral.com, probably the Internet's largest psychology webpage. Dr. James Herbert's here in the studio with me. He's a professor of psychology, director of the Anxiety Treatment Research Program at Drexel University. And when we get back, we're going to hear from Dr. Fred Thomas, an epidemiologist and clinical social worker, who's the director of community-based mental health services at the University of Texas Medical Branch in Galveston. Again, our number is 888-477-9499. We'll be back in just 1 minute. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM, Philadelphia.
Supporting WHYY, the Executive MBA program at the University of Delaware, offering an internationally accredited MBA designed to meet the needs of experienced working professionals. With classes held on weekends at the suburban Wilmington campus, this accelerated program can be completed over 19 months with the summer off. To learn about admission requirements and other program details, 302-831-2221 or emba.udel.edu.
And I said to myself, sit down.
The new Fox comedy series Glee is about a choir director and his motley group of high school singers. On the next Fresh Air, the show's creator Ryan Murphy tells us about his own experiences singing in a choir and what inspired him to create the plastic surgery series Nip Tuck. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. Digital psychotherapy, alternative psychotherapies. I'm joined by James Herbert here in the studio, professor of psychology, director of the Anxiety Treatment and Research Program at Drexel University. He set up a program on Second Life, treating people with anxiety and agoraphobia, and he's had the help of someone in a younger generation, and we'll leave it at that. I'm joined online by Dr. John Growall. He's a psychologist, founder of PsychCentral.com. And we're also joined by Dr. Fred Thomas. He's an epidemiologist and clinical social worker, director of community-based mental health services at the University of Texas in Galveston. Fred Thomas, welcome to the show. Do we have you? I guess we'll bring Fred Thomas up in just a minute. Technical problems. Getting back to digital psychotherapy. Fred Thomas?
Yes, I'm here.
Welcome to the show.
Great, thank you.
You've got a pretty unique program in Galveston. This is a pretty depressed community. who a couple of years ago got many negative findings on a report, high incidence of mental health problems, drug use, poor access to care, high pregnancy rates. So you got some cash from Robert Wood Johnson, who wanted you to do something. So what did you do?
Right. Well, the report you're speaking of was a report that had been put out biannually by a local philanthropy here in Galveston that had focused on looking at outcomes related to children. And that director of that philanthropy saw the opportunity through Robert Wood Johnson for a matching opportunity and knew UTMB's history with telepsychiatry and telemedicine. And so we proposed a program August of 2006 to RWJ with six local philanthropies matching the money, and they funded it. And so we've been going since August of 2006.
Well, it's had some evolutions, yes?
Yes, sir. The initial evolution was we really started, we got the funding without having done as much community-based work as we should have done, which was going out and saying and asking the community, the right communities, whether or not they thought this would work and where it should be and where it should be located and what the providers should look like. And so we had done some of that, but not enough. And so our first year was a little slow, and of course the stigmas and the other issues related to access in general affected that, and then we went back and did a revamp of it, and it's flying high at this
so
point.
So tell us about the IT. Clintonian.
Sir?
I hate to sound Clintonian, but what is it?
We have four interconnected clinics that are connected by electronic medical record, and we have caseworkers in each of those clinics, but when the caseworker introduces themselves to a family who's been brought into the clinic, they will lead them back into an office that's very nice, nicely furnished and painted, and nice rug on the floor. Instead of having Dr. Gottlieb sitting in the corner, there's a large flat screen television that's that the size of the clinician is the same as the size of a body that might be sitting there in person, and so the caseworker introduces the family to their clinician, and they begin their therapy session. And so we operated very much like a multidisciplinary clinic, just that the provider, the clinical provider, does their work via technology.
And they can actually. Well, I know the family can see the clinician. Can the clinician see the family?
Yes. It's very high tech in that it's top notch audio and visual. So there's immediacy in the audio and visual. So you're talking to someone who's talking right back to you.
All right,
go ahead.
Let's expand the picture here. I mean, we live in a world today where if a child shows a psychiatric symptom, they may be lucky enough to see a good therapist, maybe. And sometimes they'll get medication, but any clinician knows that symptom could be the result of a family that's dysfunction, and that dysfunction could be the result of health problems, economic distress, or simply lack of parenting skills. Does your program provide those services?
Yes, sir. The program, and I think that's a addressed through the multidisciplinary aspect of it, in that our casework mechanism and the determination of who sees when on what days is done by a group of clinicians that include an MD, psychiatrists, include master-level psychologists, and social workers. And so we make the determine based upon race and SES and background and the other issues to which clinician the child and their family would be referred to. And then our clinics themselves are housed within a primary care clinic that is school-based. So any of the primary health issues that need to be done are done across the door. So anything... Yes, sir?
Could you give us an example, a personal story? What does this look like?
Well, it looks like in both issues, in a older and younger children. I mean, we get a lot of
children who have not had access to care at all, and they have been struggling with school and most likely are on the road to either dropping out or having at least reduced academic success. And the teachers or the counselors or their parents are just fed up. They don't have any access. They don't know what to do, and so they've just done without. And we provide that access. And so any number of situations where children and their parents have been at their wit's end and who at this point, anytime we ask for anything related to them, speaking about how it's provided care for them or asking their parents to be a part of any sort of story we're writing, they gush about giving anything they can because we've done so much for them. An individual story, I was in the first year looking at trying to find parents who were coming in because we've had few, and I was wanting to talk to certain parents and ask them, well, how has it been for you? Tell me what it felt like, and tell me whether or not it has affected your family. And I was sitting in my office with a mother who was fiddling with her purse and looking through. I thought she was just not really paying attention, and I said, well, just tell me about your experience. And she looked up, and she just looked at me, and she was trying to gather herself because she was crying, and she looked up at me, and she said, it's changed our lives. And it's just the impact in people who have children who have mental health issues or have them themselves understand what I'm talking about. It just when they finally do get a connection with someone who does help them, and it changes their academic, it changes their home, it changes their social, it does change their lives.
I wonder about those who don't have access to these clinics. Many communities don't have services like that. I mean, is there a way to get access to these services remotely?
Well, we are limited to Galveston County, which is Galveston Island, and then the community that's the mainland around, which is a community altogether about 250,000 people. But the Galveston Island population proper is about 50,000 or 45,000 now after a hurricane we had in September. And so we actually have been asked by any number of school districts to please open up to allow our services to their students, and we haven't been able to. Our funding limits us to Galveston and the students of the school districts here.
Where are your therapists physically?
Well, there's one in San Antonio, Texas, which is, I guess, a couple of hundred, 300 miles away. There's one in three in Houston, Texas, which is about 60 miles away, and there's one in Clear Lake, Texas, which is about 35 miles away.
Well, theoretically, they could be anywhere in the country in the world.
They could be you.
I've got an opening on Tuesday at 2.
All right.
Actually, I lied. I don't. But it's really an interesting. It's an interesting perspective. I wonder, and I want to open this up to John and James. I wonder if there's something we can learn from this program, a way to generalize. I mean, this is a program that helps lots of people. It does not seem inordinately expensive. John, let me turn to you on this.
I think programs like this could be fantastic if we could find the money to fund them, and as you said, it's not an expensive intervention, and that's the key, is that in tough economic times, of course, it's hard to justify new spending, but this is just an example of how low-cost online kind of based interventions can really be beneficial.
And cheaper than psychotherapy, than traditional psychotherapy, I would think.
Or at least
absolutely, and I think that's one of the keys to all online therapy interventions is that it can be offered in a less expensive manner. It isn't always, but it certainly can be, and it can certainly cut down costs and offer benefits to people with a wide variety of concerns.
James?
Yeah, I would just say two things. First, the initial outlay. Part of the problem with these new programs is that, I mean, this is an incredible program. That's obvious. But you've got that initial cost, the initial outlay. And so often in our health economics of our healthcare system, the emphasis is on the short term rather than the longer term. That's a perennial problem. The second thing I would say is a key part of that program, and I think something that is reflected in our program as well, is getting the expertise, the right expertise to the person. It's not just that every therapist is a jack of all trades, but if there's someone in California who needs the kinds of services that we can provide here in Philadelphia, for example, or vice versa, then these technologies allow that matching of expertise.
And these technologies also create potential danger for that reason. You know, we don't know. I mean, you know who you hire, and Fred Thomas, you know who you hire, but we don't know who we get when we go online. Let's go to the phones. We've got Liz on the line. Liz, hi, you're on Voices. Liz?
Thanks for taking my call. I'm just was listening to your program, and I started using a therapist online back in January. I found him through some research with some problems I was having clinically, and his area of expertise matched identical to the issues I was facing with family, with sport, with media, with anxiety, with depression. And so he's based out of New York. I live in Pennsylvania, and I'm able to utilize his services. It's been a wonderful connection, and he's really seen me through some very dark times and helped me get through the very crisis part of the problems I was having and into a much healthier place right now.
Online. Is this online or on telephone?
On telephone, actually.
Do you miss, I mean, do you want to, do you have an urge to see him or vice versa?
I would like to meet him. I believe I would. There's been some moments where I felt like I would like to have face-to-face conversation, but I really find that his like I said, his area of expertise, he's seen, he understands the problems that I've had. They're kind of an interconnected web of chain of events that have led to where I was having difficulty. So he presented me with a very, very, very professional business plan, I should say, or I should say his resume that he sent to me. I was initially concerned about starting a phone relationship
right.
with the therapist, but he sent me some very professional word to use.
You got his credentials. I think that was really smart on your part.
Absolutely. Yeah. And he enhanced the therapeutic process with written testimonials, not only from other people, but from just some readings that I'm able to do. So there's ways to enhance the therapeutic relationship
that I
can take on my own.
That's really interesting. Liz, thanks so much for your call. That's quite an interesting perspective. I've got another perspective, and I guess I'll turn to you, John. I'm treating someone in Seattle. I know her family. I've met her once many years ago. But she's got a debilitating disability, which seems to be getting worse, and she wants to talk with me and only me. I've got quadriplegia and have for 30 years. So there's that unique connection. The question I have is, I'm not licensed in Seattle. I'm licensed in Pennsylvania as a psychologist, in Jersey as a family therapist. So how does that work? I'm almost scared to get the answer.
You've certainly raised an interesting point and one that the field has grappled with to some degree over the past decade, that online services have been offered. And the answer is that we really don't know what the upshot of any kind of legal or licensing issues would be regarding the provision of online therapy across state boundaries or even across international boundaries. The Internet doesn't really make any differentiation when you jump to a website in Canada or the UK or Australia.
Yeah, we are really going to have to rethink credentialing and what it means and,
apparently,
all that stuff. James?
There's an APA committee looking at this now, and we consulted before we started our project with the American Psychological Association as well as the state board here in Pennsylvania to try to get some clear, definitive answers. And we were able to get some guidance and the green light to move ahead, but as John said, it's still up in the air. The one thing I'd return to briefly, the issue about the expertise, I agree with you that the online environment raises issues there, but honestly, I don't think they're any different than the issues that you have face-to-face. I mean,
yeah.
How do people find therapists face-to-face? They go by word of mouth, sometimes the referral of a doctor, sometimes they open the phone book. And there are a lot of people in the phone book that I wouldn't send a family member to.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think it's important that the consumer be a savvy shopper, so to speak, and do their homework like Liz, the caller, did and got the credentials. But I really don't think that the online environment necessarily creates more of a challenge in that regard.
That's interesting.
I'd like to cue in here, if I may.
Sure.
There have been a few families, not many, who have come back to us and said, we're just not a match with the person that we were seeing. And that's discussed by the clinical team and with the clinician of who they didn't fit well with. And we go back through and we re-refer them to another one of the clinicians. But not very often. I mean, I think the people that we're seeing appreciate the continuity of care. They appreciate that we've taken a role and just trying to determine the best fit for them, and then they have gotten good care. So there are a few that haven't been good fits, and they've come back around and been re-referred.
Which is what happens in traditional
right.
face-to-face therapy. Let's right. see if we can get another call on before we have to go to break. We've got Catherine on the phone. Catherine, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to sort of talk about my experience with over the phone therapy and also comparing that to my current therapy, which is face-to-face. And in regards to the social anxiety that I experienced, the phone seemed almost like I could focus a little bit more on the topics that we covered. And sort of when I'm face-to-face, I get flustered and am unable to kind of focus. Well, I'm more focused on how the therapist is even viewing me and in a judgmental light or whatever I'm dealing with that on that day. But with the phone, it was almost like I was able to get more done and focus on focus on more goals and accomplish more.
James Herbert?
Yeah, that makes sense. I think that some of what we've found is some of the people that we have been treating actually appear to be more severe than the people that we see faced in our face-to-face practice in the clinic. These are people who really have a difficult time even coming to see a therapist. And so, and I have to admit, we didn't anticipate that ahead of time. We were looking at this more as an access issue, and we were sort of surprised to find that. So I think your experience makes sense.
Catherine, can I ask you a question? When you work on the telephone, what's your goal? Is your goal to be able to get in there face-to-face, or do you have a different goal?
Well, I don't think I have any expectation to go in there face-to-face. I mean, I knew that option was there, but it was sort of, she kind of told me the benefits of over the phone, and I went with it. And before each session, actually, we had an email going where I would write and say what I wanted to focus on. And so, and I knew that I had access to email her at any time in between the sessions, too. That was kind of part of the deal. So I really appreciated that. And you know, for me, writing was also a better form of expression anyway, and I can focus better on that than the face-to-face. So I think eventually, you know, now I'm in that face-to-face situation with another therapist, and so, you know, I've got there to some degree, but I just remember that the benefits of the phone conversations.
Yeah, that's really an interesting perspective, and it does fit. exactly with what James told us earlier in the show. We are talking about digital psychotherapy, alternative psychotherapies today on Voices. Our phone number is 888-477-9499. Give us a call. Tell us how you feel about them. Tell us if you've ever experienced them, if you're in a chat room or on a blog and have found that therapeutic, or if your therapist is online. Give us your thoughts. 888-477-9499. We're joined by Dr. Fred Thomas, who's an epidemiologist, started a very unique program out at out in Galveston, Texas. He's a epidemiologist and director of the community-based mental health services out there. I'm also joined by John Growall. He's a psychologist, founder of PsychCentral.com, the one of the most respected websites in psychology on the Internet. I'm also joined here in the studio by Dr. James Herbert, professor of psychology, director of the Anxiety Treatment and Research Program at Drexel University. Well, you're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM, Philadelphia. Take me
out! Scottish band Franz Ferdinand is known for its strong grooves and bold guitars. So what happens when you strip it all away?
If a song is strong, you can reduce it to something that can be played on an acoustic guitar. The best of any songs can be reduced to that kind of level.
That's Alex Kapranos of Franz Ferdinand, ready to take the acoustic challenge this week on Sound Opinions.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
Hi, I'm Michelle Martin. On my show, Tell Me More, we look behind the headlines to see what's really happening around the country and the world, from Zimbabwe to right here in Philadelphia. As the city suffered through an outbreak of violence, we heard from community activists like Kenny Gamble.
We are peacemakers. We are trying to make a model here in Philadelphia.
And we will bring you more stories that tell us more about who we are and where we live. Tell Me More, weekdays at 1 on WHYY, Philadelphia's NPR news station.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about online or on telephone psychotherapy. We're with John Growall, psychologist, founder of PsychCentral.com. Fred Thomas, he's an epidemiologist at Galveston, Texas, started a very unique program out there. James Herbert's a professor of psychology, director of the Anxiety Treatment Research and Research Program at Drexel, and he started a very unique program on Second Life, treating anxiety disorders. I want to come back to this program on Second Life. You use a program, not just cognitive behavioral therapy, it's mindfulness-based. What is that, and how do you communicate that message in Second Life?
All in 30 words or less, right?
Right.
Well, it is a cognitive behavioral program, broadly speaking, but we've been doing for the past 10 years in our group, in our clinic, we've been using these acceptance-based and mindfulness-based techniques to, we marry them within the cognitive behavioral framework. So it's not completely separate from that. So we still do a lot of the traditional cognitive behavioral stuff. For example, role-playing. We use a lot of role-playing in our clinic. We'll have people role-play things that are difficult for them. And where the mindfulness piece comes in is how to cope with the anxiety that those role-plays provoke. And traditional forms of cognitive behavior therapy are more focused on reappraising, changing the way one thinks about the situation in hopes of lowering the anxiety. Whereas from a more mindfulness-based perspective, the idea is to notice and accept the distressing thoughts and feelings without fighting them, but to still engage in the behavior in question. So,
well now, mindfulness-based therapy also employs something called metacognition, so that you literally get out of your mind and look at your mind and you watch your thinking. So now we have metacognition where you are out of your mind looking at your mind in a dispassionate way, not getting caught up in it, and you're doing that in a virtual reality, which is way too complicated for me to even begin to fathom.
Right. It actually sounds more complicated than it really is if you watch it happen. But part of this, again, is generational. One of my main faculty collaborators, Evan Foreman, we do our work together. He's about 10 years younger than me. And then a student, Erica Ewan, who is about 10 years younger than him, is also working on this. And you can see that I think Evan's a little more naturally comfortable with this stuff than I am in terms of the technology. And then Erica, in turn, even more comfortable than Aaron, than Evan. So I think that it part of it's generational. But, you know, it's interesting. Once you get into it, it's amazing how real and natural it starts to feel. It doesn't take long. It's actually surprising.
John, one of the assets of this kind of therapy is about its anonymity. Is there any research about who might seek online therapy and who might not look to traditional therapies?
There is a little bit of research that helps us understand who's seeking out online therapy, and as mentioned earlier. Surprisingly, we're finding that people who actually have pretty serious disorders often will seek out online therapy. I think it does have to relate to and is due to the anonymity that it is easier to talk to someone on the internet virtually than it would be face to face for something that's very serious. I mean, as you know, therapists sometimes take for granted that the amount of motivation and focus that a person needs to have in order to actually make that first psychotherapy appointment with a therapist face to face. So, I see online therapy as potentially also a stepping stone to face to face for some people.
We've got Sarah on the line. Sarah, hi, you're on Voices.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks. How about you?
I can't hear you very well, but I was just calling because I think that this conversation is very, very interesting. I'm a little worried. I had read some research about the way that mirror neurons trigger or don't trigger online versus face-to-face therapy, and I was wondering what the guys thought about the development and triggering of mirror neurons when people are seeing each other over the internet or talking over the phone versus individual therapy.
I'd like to speak to that.
Yeah, please, John. Thank you for your call, Sarah.
Hi. I think that we offer a very nice middle ground on that, and that for the folks who have social anxiety or issues about interacting with new people or struggle with that sort of thing, they still are seeing their clinician through the television screen, but they still do have that personal connection with a smiling face, with someone who you can see their effect and you can see vice versa. And so it does offer that separation a bit, but it does also provide the opportunity to see the person you're talking to and provide that connection.
Yeah, I imagine with video, it's very, very close to in person. But I wonder about things like chat rooms or email psychotherapy or even telephone, John.
I would only add that that is one of the major issues with a lot of the online therapy being done today is the lack of nonverbal cues and nonverbal communication, which we know is being very important to people talking to each other. So I think there are ways that people work around that, and as a whole new generation of individuals grow up online or texting with one another and Twittering, they really do learn to find words to express their emotions rather than relying on those nonverbal cues.
One final question. I'll turn to you, James. People say that online therapy is great, that it can fit into a busy schedule. But what if a busy schedule is part of the problem that causes you to need therapy in the first place?
Well, that's a good point. I think a lot of these issues, I guess my bottom line is we need a lot more research to find out what works and what doesn't work and for whom things work. It may very well be, the caller's question about the mirror neurons, for example, it may very well be that for some kinds of problems, certain technologies work better than others, and it may be there are certain kinds of problems that nothing but traditional face-to-face is going to suffice. But ultimately, we don't know until we go find out what works. And we can't just rely on our feelings of awkwardness because, you know, it may be awkward in some of these technologies. Not having the nonverbals for me is very awkward at times. And I have to find, when I'm doing this on Second Life, I have to emphasize the paralinguistic, the tonality, that sort of thing to communicate some of the cues that you don't have verbally.
Well, it still may work.
Well, you know
from mindfulness based cognitive therapy that your job is to tolerate your awkwardness
and to be able to sit with it and
not be reactive. I wonder if you could have a quick reaction to my question, John. Are we being enablers sometimes if we allow interaction with somebody who's, you know, working 23 hours a day and we can squeeze in a session on that 24th?
I think it's interesting to look at it that way, but ultimately I don't want to take away a person's self-reliance and independence to make such decisions on their own.
That's a good point. Well, unfortunately, we have to say goodbye. I want to thank all three of you so much. It's really been an interesting show. More research is needed, as they say. My guests have been James Herbert, a professor of psychology, director of the Anxiety Treatment and Research Program at Drexel University, John Growall, psychologist and founder of PsychCentral.com. I recommend you check that out. I was also joined by Fred Thomas, an epidemiologist, clinical social worker, and he runs the community-based mental health services at the University of Texas over in Galveston. Hey, join me on my live, speaking of technology, on my live web chat tomorrow where we will be talking about depression. I'm at, that's philly.com/askdan. Well, if you want to reach us, we are at voices@whyy.org, and you can find archive editions of the show there also. And you can reach me at drdangottlieb.com. The engineer for the show has been Al Banks. Thank you, Al. Elizabeth Purvis-Luna is our executive producer of radio content at WHYY. Our executive producer is Mike and Scott. Voices in the Family is produced by Gita Simons. Alisa Walters, the birthday girl, is our associate producer. Our intern is Jonathan Glick. And me, I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. Enjoy your week, my friends.